Support for WPR comes from Luther College in Decorah, Iowa. Academic scholarships are automatically offered to eligible students upon admission, and all Luther students receive some form of financial aid. Luther.edu.
Good morning, I'm Jim Packard, sitting in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you along with us today as we go with our weekly edition of Garden Talk. And here in the studio is Bob Tomesch. He's a senior lecturer at the UW Madison and Extension Horticulture. And Bob, it's a pleasure to see you again.
Yes, Jim, and it's good to be back.
And here it is in January. We're sort of following the trend of last January when we had the warmest month on record as far as National Weather Service record keeping. We're on track today. What do you see in terms of the impact on plants?
I like your introduction. It's a January like last year, and I know we were all keeping our fingers crossed as to what plant material we might have lost or anything like that. But if you remember last spring, things did come through fairly well. So let's keep that under our hat as something to remember and fall back on. We are getting reports of people seeing some of the spring bulb crops beginning to emit some growth. That's only leaf tissue. The actual flower bud is down next to the bulb yet. And so those plants, if we do have some cold weather, yes, those leaves will freeze off, and the plant will continue to grow when we do have some warm weather. So we're okay yet, even though we're seeing some growth. One of the problem areas will probably be in some of the types of trees and shrubs that were kind of at the northern limit for survival. If they've had their chilling requirement, we'll begin to see their buds begin to swell. And if we have temperatures then dropping below zero, then we might see some damage there. I've seen cases where some of the terminal shoots in past years have been damaged, but or the flower structures were reduced. But we kind of have to wait it out. We don't know. It's quite open, as you can tell. And if we have some temperatures that start dropping below zero, we may see some damage to the root systems more than to the top portion.
Well, we have lines open for your Garden Talk question or comment. And if you'd like to make one, in Madison, the number is 263-1890. Otherwise, it's toll-free at 800-642-1234. And, of course, our email address is talk@wpr.org. Holiday trees are done, and garlands and boughs, can they be used again in some fashion in the garden?
That's a very good point, because we probably need to be protecting some of our herbaceous perennial root systems. As I've been watching, they're kind of at that freeze-thaw. We have two situations for damage. Not only the cold, but also that freezing and thawing will force some of the roots to break and crack. And then in the spring, when it begins to warm up, we may have see some bacterial infections, which weakens the plant. It flowers probably very poorly that season until it either succumbs to the disease or, on the other hand, grows its way out of it. Those boughs that we have left over, if you can use those as mulch, placing those over the herbaceous perennials. And what that will do is tend to shade that soil at this time and keep that temperature more at an even keel. If it freezes, it'll stay frozen. And as the sun shines, it won't thaw down. So that can give some protection in that respect. So I'd have, if you have some, spread those around some of the perennial beds. They're very easy to clean up in the spring and move on to some of the recycling shrubbery centers across the state.
Bob Tomesch is our guest, and let's go to the phones, take some calls, and we'll start off with Ron in Madison. Hello, Ron. What's on your mind?
The climate chaos that's started is the main concern, which you guys have already alluded to a little bit about plowing in January, planting trees in January. Years ago, after researching into the climate change a bit, I concluded that both big government and big business would do virtually nothing to stop the problem or even slow it down. So I began thinking, what can we do? What must we do? And the conclusion I came to is we must help the trees migrate toward the poles and up the mountains, if you have mountains in the state where you live. And so I figured black walnuts from Missouri and Kansas would be suited to Wisconsin in the near future. But with the rapid change here, I'm debating whether that was a mistake. Should I be trying to get the large pecans from way down south and live oak acorns from the Gulf of Mexico coastline? How rapidly will it change? The reason I ask is the pecan trees historically reach peak production of pecan nuts between the age of 75 and 200 years. So we need to have the right kind of pecans planted here that will survive during the 22nd and the 23rd century with whatever climate we realistically might have. Is it wise then to pick pecans from Missouri and from Louisiana and Mississippi and mix them together and plant them in every plantation that way so that whether the climate gets 5 degrees hotter or 10 degrees hotter or 15 degrees hotter, we'll have something that will survive in the new climate? Because the native trees that are here, the white pine, for example, are likely to be extinct in Wisconsin. And the sugar maple, especially sugar maple, they've done research on, is likely to be extinct in the U.S. totally. Thanks.
Okay, you've tossed out a lot to think about there. Again, we're gambling. We don't know if this is a trend or just an unusual winter that we do have. We look back, and I believe it was the winter of 97 was somewhat similar to this, and we've had others about 100 years ago. It was also, I think, 1932 was quite similar to this. They're talking about Lake Mendota freezing over in the end of January and some of those types of data things. Just to give you talking about selecting plants from farther south, if we have one bad winter, those plants are gone. They cannot tolerate certain temperatures. And also, even certain plants, like I'll use pecans, there are some that do grow in Missouri, and there are some that grow in some of the southern states like Texas. Usually those varieties have evolved in that region, like Missouri, surviving on those temperatures. And if you go down to Texas and pull those this far north, two problems. One, they're not as cold tolerant. And the other thing is sometimes those plants will produce their seeds over 200 days of frost-free period. We don't have that yet, even though we're looking into the crystal balling some of those things. So if you're selecting plant materials, I would still stick with what you have or what we have in terms of recommendations for black walnuts and some of those things. And usually it's a hardy stock that's growing here in the near northern regions of the state. As for pecans, we have been looking at some varieties at one of the research stations in terms of winter survival, and they've been in the ground for 20-some years, and yes, they are surviving. The tree itself may survive, but what we do find is sometimes the flower buds or flower structures are damaged during the winter months, and so they just are not productive. And some of the trees we have there, I think out of one plot of maybe 100 trees, we have one that's beginning to produce some fruit. The others, we maybe were a little too early in terms of the hardiness factor. So mm-hmm. We're looking at some of those things.
Is Missouri sort of the closest source for a pecan?
No, Illinois, northern Illinois, there's some
varieties.
They've
advanced up there.
Yes. Usually those are not name varieties. Those are just native selections that seem to be fairly productive. Illinois had been doing some grafting of selected varieties and trying some of those. But you can try them, see what happens. Like, no guarantees.
That's right.
That.
And take the long view on that. Ron,
yes.
Thank you very much for your call. We appreciate hearing from you. Our guest is Bob Tomesch. He's a senior lecturer in horticulture at the UW-Madison. And let's go to Don next in La Crosse. Hi, Don.
Hi there.
Go ahead.
Okay. I planted some bean seeds for a science project, and I'm a master gardener, and I got a problem now. And I didn't know you could plant bean seeds upside down because I got roots coming up through the top of the ground. What caused that?
That's a stumper.
I called another master gardener, and she had no idea either.
What are they actually pointing upward?
Yeah, the roots actually pointed right out of the ground, and I turned them around and replanted them again.
Yeah. I don't think it's planting the seed upside down. I'd have to look at that. There's a few things that can happen. Sometimes when the bean develops, if there's a node close to the surface, roots will develop there, and they're right near the surface. Sometimes if you're watering the plants too much, the roots keep working their way up near the surface, and so your soil might be a little bit too wet down below.
Okay.
It could be that it's too cold if you have them on a windowsill or something like that. Beans are very heat sensitive.
I've got them under grow lights in the basement.
So. Oh, you're treating them very well.
Right.
The other thing that you've got them under grow lights, so you won't see some of those other things. But for example, I know my son had a project where they brought home the bean plant from school, and it's still growing. The only thing is we don't have it under grow lights. We have it near a window, and because the days are shorter and the light intensity is less, it's kind of leggy. Some of those plants will not produce flowers because the light intensity is strong enough to initiate those types of things. So in your case of aerial roots, I'd have to see the situation and see what's going on there to make an evaluation. Usually they don't come to the surface unless there's something not quite right down below.
Yeah, because I know I've planted them for years, and it's the first year it's ever happened to me. So
I can see why it was a mystery then.
Yeah. Okay, thanks.
All right, Don, good luck. Hope you find an answer. And on to Joya in Fitchburg. Hi, Joya. Yes, go ahead. You know, if you listen with the radio turned up, why, then you're listening to about 10 seconds behind us, which is in this case.
Hi.
Yes.
Thank you for having him, Jim.
Yes.
I have a question. Is, you know, usually all the perennials at this time of the year are covered with the snow and moisture. And now, this year, there is no snow. So what do we do? Do we take the buds of perennial like mums and, you know, lilies and small plants like phlox? What do we do? We mulch them more, or we take them, leave them as they are?
Well, mulching them would definitely help. What that's going to do is protect those root structures that are near the soil surface. And there's nothing wrong with mounding some bark chips or any other type of mulch 4 to 6 inches up the plant. And if you have roses, the same thing. What that does do is protect from the temperature fluctuations. And also, if we have some severe cold where the temperatures are going to drop. Normally, soil temperatures are somewhere in the high 20s, even when we have snow or anything else. We had an open winter about 3 years ago or 4 years ago where we had soil temperatures dropping down to that 15 and 17 degree range up in the Spooner area at one of the research stations. And in locations like that, we did see damage to plant tissue because they can't acclimate or drop. They don't develop the hardiness in the root system like it does in the above ground portion. So your suggestion in mulching is a very good idea. I'd highly recommend people, if you do have some access to some bark chips or even leaf tissue, works very well. Take a cone, build it out of wire, kind of a circular type cone, place about 10 inches of leaf tissue above that root zone or that crown where the plant is evolving, whether it's mums or anything else, and that'll provide better growth and productivity for the growing season.
Should we do the same thing for the roses too?
Good idea for roses. Most of the roses are grown on their own roots now. Years ago when we had a lot of grafted roses, and some roses are still grafted, what would happen in a severe winter is the top portion could not develop the hardiness, but usually the roots would survive, and so you'd see some regrowth of maybe a wild-type rose of whatever the root system happened to be. But with mulching, what you're doing is protecting some of those lower buds. If you look on some of the roses that are borderline in terms of hardiness for our area, usually they will die back down to maybe 6 inches above the ground, and pruning them back that far and stimulate some new growth, and they will come back into a flowering phase whenever that happens to be for that particular rose variety.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate hearing from you. And on to Brian. And before Brian comes on the air, let me just say the lines are open. And if you have a question for Bob Tomisch, give us a call in Madison at 263-1890 or toll-free at 800-642-1234. Now, Brian, go ahead.
Hi, fellas. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
My question is that it's always supposed to be a good time to throw grass seed out in October, but with our warm weather and stuff like that, what's it like now? Is it going to survive, or can you give me any hint?
Well, with grass seed, usually we suggest planting grass seed before September 15th. Those seeds will germinate, and they need about a 6-week growing period in order to not only grow but also produce some sugars to overwinter and have some sugars to start growing for the following year, or starches, whatever it happens to be. So what you're talking about is primarily dormant seeding, And what that is placing the seeds out now. And the temperatures have to be, at least the soil temperature, above 40 degrees before those seeds will even start germinating. So what people do is seed late in the fall or through the winter months, and really the growth doesn't happen until spring. Now, you have to think about the fact that many of these seeds grew up in a natural environment where the seeds are released in late fall from the plant itself, and then the following spring they will grow when the conditions are right. And so what you're doing is spreading out seed and hoping that when the conditions are right in the spring they will begin to grow. A couple of challenges that you'll have is, one, some of the ground feeding birds like working on those seeds, as well as other little critters, so you're going to lose some of your seed population. Wind can blow some of those seeds away, or with the grounds being semi-frozen, and if we have rain and there's runoff, your seeds go to the bottom of the hill. So that's why normally when they do some dormant seeding in November, December, just as the ground is freezing up, they'll often put straw mulch or something like that down and try to work it into the soil a little bit to help hold everything in place.
Okay, great. Well, listen, thank you very much for your answer there.
Mm-hmm.
Can I just throw something else in here?
What is that?
Is there a possibility of seed going bad, carrying it from one year to another?
Yes, it can. You're talking about grass seed in particular?
Right.
Yes, grass seed has a relatively short life. John Steyer could probably answer this better, but I'm guessing between 3 and 5 years, and after that, the germination rate goes way down. Well, if you have some old seed, what you might want to do is count on 100 seeds, place it between a couple of paper towels, set it on the windowsill, and then after a few days, you can kind of open up, we call that a rag doll, open up that paper and keep it moist during that time and see how many seeds have emitted a root system. And that'll give you a percent germination. Normally on a bag, it's going to say the germination rate is somewhere around 90 to maybe 99%. But if you store those, it's going to reduce the germination. It might be down as low as 30%, so you're going to need three times the amount of seed on your application of maybe it'll say 2 pounds per so many square feet. You probably want to go to 6 pounds. So that's one thing. The other thing is, it depends how you store the seed. Often we place it in the garage. Well, in the garage, it's not only a dry environment, but also during the summer months, it gets very hot. And so some of the seed becomes less viable as a result of that.
Okay, well, thank you very much for your time. Happy New Year, fellas.
All right, Brian, thank you. Happy New Year to you. And if you'd like to join in, the number in Madison is 263-1890. Otherwise, toll free at 800-642-1234. Our guest on Garden Talk is Bob Tomesch. He's a senior lecturer in horticulture with the University of Wisconsin and University Extension here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Jim Packard, sitting in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network. Glad to have you along with us for Garden Talk. Bob Tomesch is our guest. The lines are full. And if you'd like to join in, you might jot this down. The Madison number is 263-1890. Otherwise, toll free at 800-642-1234. Or you talk with Keisha Mabra, who's on air producing today. Let's go to the phones again to Nancy in Milwaukee. Hello, Nancy.
Hi. My question is, I've been fighting the war against garlic mustard for about 3 years without a lot of success. And right now, with the warm weather, the garlic mustard is really obvious. I'm wondering if this is a good time to do something about it, and if so, what?
This would be probably not the best time, because if you're going to use any herbicides, they really do not work chemically until the temperature is about 50 degrees. Normally, when we're applying some of these products, we like to see 50 degrees for at least 4 hours. In order for that chemical reaction to take place in the plant material. I know they're very obvious because the garlic mustard starts its little transplants in the fall, and so they're all sitting there nice and green, and they are actually probably carrying on some photosynthesis, because I believe their point for growing is someplace in the mid-30s, and so in the Milwaukee area, your soil is probably not frozen. And so, yes, they are carrying on some photosynthesis. That's why they look so green. And I notice even some of the clovers in the Madison area are looking a little bit green. There are some very good extension bulletins on controlling garlic mustard. The DNR, along with the UW Extension, have been working very closely together. And I just came from a meeting where all of us were meeting. And the person that's involved in working with garlic mustard was also at that meeting. I would pick up those bulletins, or if you have a computer, you can go on the internet and look at garlic mustard, and they'll talk about some controls. And in the spring, just as things begin to grow, garlic mustard is very aggressive and starts growing early, and so that'd be a good time to be controlling it. So I'd wait until spring. We've got two issues with garlic mustard. You have the live plant tissue, which you can eliminate, but there's also a seed bank that's there, and providing some control of that seed bank to keep it from germinating is the other aspect.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
All right, Nancy, thank you. Good luck to you. And on to Louise in Milwaukee. Louise, what's on your mind today?
I'm interested in planting blueberry bushes on the south side of my garage. However, my garage is south side is definitely shaded at this time of year, but in the height of summer, the ground there receives the full sun. So I go from full shade to full sun depending on the season. And I'm wondering if blueberry bushes would do well and produce good fruit under those conditions.
As long as they receive full sun during the growing period, which starts sometime in April, the more sun they receive, the more productivity that any of these plants are going to be. With growing blueberries, one, you might want to do a soil test to see where your soils are in terms of pH. They do like a more acid environment, and by that I'm saying pH soils down in the 5 range, and they'll even do a pH down in the 4 range. So you might want to do a soil test. If you have a higher pH, there is a bulletin on growing blueberries in Wisconsin that talks about mediating the soil. In other words, purchasing something like ammonium sulfate or a sulfur product, working it into the soil ahead of time to begin to reduce the soil pH. Another suggestion that I would have is blueberries, whenever you're growing them and you try to mediate the soil, I'd use about 4 inches of bark chips or something like that, or organic mulch material. That also helps allow for better absorption of nutrients. And part of the problem with blueberries is they have a very poor root system in terms of the fact they do not have any root hairs, and so their ability to get water and nutrients is challenging. And when they're stressed a little bit because of wrong soil pH, that's why they become less productive. The other aspect with blueberries is that you need to water them at least once a week, if not twice a week. The fact is, that, again, they don't have the ability to get water out of the soil like other plants. And so with the watering, you're going to ensure better growth. If they dry out for a two-week period, you not only see the stress of that year, but you also see the stress the following year, in the fact that it'll damage the flower buds for the following season. So in your case, try to moderate the pH. The other thing is to keep the bark chips on and then keep them watered very well, and I think you'll do fine.
Another quick question. Do deer like blueberries?
Yes.
Okay.
So do rabbits and so do everything else. Yes, they will feed on them.
Okay.
There's some products that you can spray on the blueberries to keep them away. Now they have a little electrical shockers that you can place amongst the blueberry plants, and so when the deer come in and working on the blueberries, they touch the little electric shock. It's battery operated, and it's supposed to keep them away. We're trying some of these things and see what kind of results. But yes, they do love blueberries.
Okay, thanks very much.
Okay, mm-hmm. Thank you, Louise. Good luck to you. And our next call is going to be John, and John's in Mount Horeb. Hi, John.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
I vaguely recall reading that repeated freezing and thawing is important for the quality of the soil in a state like Wisconsin. And I was wondering if you could tell me if that's true, and if we have several mild winters in a row, what kind of changes might we expect? And I'll just hang up and listen.
All right.
Yeah, the freezing and thawing is very important because it tends to kind of loosen the soil up in terms of allowing air spaces in. And that air space is either air or water. If we take a shovel full of soil, 50% of that is that fluctuation between air and water, depending on what the season happens to be. So the freeze and thaw from that aspect is very good. It's very good from the standpoint when we plant our seeds in the spring, because we have those spaces, the roots can penetrate through the soil. So that's the advantage of the freeze and thaw aspect. For our perennials, it's always not quite so advantageous. And some of those things I alluded to earlier in the fact that it can cause some cold damage if we have some cold temperatures that follow this warm period. The other thing, the freeze and thaw will tend to expand and contract the soil, and in doing so, it will rip some of the roots of those perennials, and the end result is that it allows for an infection site. So we have both an advantage situation and a disadvantage situation.
You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, and we have some lines open. If you have a question, you can get on quite rapidly. In Madison, the number is 263-1890. Otherwise, it's toll-free at 800-642-1234. And let's see what's on Brian's mind in Mauston. Go ahead, Brian.
Hi, thanks for having me on. Mm-hmm. My question is, my mother has bought a new house and is moving, and she wants to move some of the plants from the old house to the new house, one of which is a lilac bush, and the other are just some perennials that are in a garden. And I'm wondering if, seeing how it's such a mild time of year and the ground isn't frozen, if it's okay to dig them up and plant them, or if it's going to be rough on them to do that while they're in that dormancy period.
Yes, I would wait until the real thaw comes in March or April when the soil thaws out and move them as soon as you can. At that time, they're going to survive best. What happens now is if you move them, you're placing them into a new environment, and they're very open to the freeze and thaw. Now, if you've purchased a house, you've got a couple of choices. Sometimes you can work out a contract with the new buyer that when spring rolls around, you can move the plants. If you're forced to it where you can't do anything, and the ground is thawed enough that you can move them, I would move them, but like your perennials. And once you move those, you're in a risk situation, depending on what the environment's going to dole out for us. But I would definitely place about 4 or 5 inches of mulch over those plant materials. Then in the spring, when it begins to thaw, kind of work it away to expose that crown area. So if you're forced to move it, I would, rather than lose the plant material, try it. But and then mulch heavily. Otherwise, wait until early spring and then move them with the season.
Okay. All right, thanks.
All right, Brian, thank you very much for your call. You know, nursery catalogs are arriving in the mail, and we've had a number of questions that deal with winter hardiness issues. Is there a greater variety, greater choice of winter hardy plants now than there were 5, 10 years ago?
Well, we're probably splitting hairs more now than we did in the past, in that we've taken certain varieties of plants and tried them at different areas. For example, lilacs. There's a huge lilac collection out at the University Arboretum, and then we also have some plant materials at some of the other sites across the state. And we're always acquiring information. And there are certain varieties that are able to tolerate our temperatures as we get into northern Wisconsin more readily than others. When you're looking at garden catalogs, look at it. Oftentimes now they will tell you what zones that these plants will survive in. Let's say that you're in northern Wisconsin and it's a zone 3. You can pick a zone 4 plant, but if we have a very severe winter, which might come to 2 or 3 years down the road, you may lose that plant. And for years, I would set materials out across northern Wisconsin from the University of Iowa and a few other places. They'd send it to me to see if I could kill it in their hardiness trials, and I could usually prove that I could. So when you're looking at the garden catalogs, look at the zoning. If you're right on close to that zone that's going to survive, I would really hesitate and take a look. There's also a very good extension publication. It's called A Guide to Selecting Landscape Plants for Wisconsin. That's available on the e-commerce website or at your local county extension office. And it will list common plants. It might not go into those minor varieties selections, but it'll list a number of those, and it'll tell you exactly zone 3, 4, or 5. And these are before we place materials in that bulletin, we usually have tested them a number of years. So I would look at kind of compare the garden catalog to that in terms of making a selection. I see a lot of plant material because the garden catalogs are no longer localized to a part of the state. They might go out to 4 or 5 states, and so they carry plant materials in there that are probably good for Illinois or good for southern Iowa. We bring those plants this far north and
get them in the bud.
It does.
Gene, let's get you up next. Go ahead.
Hi. Super sweet hybrids, the SH2 type of corn, are difficult, well, they take warmer soil temperatures to germinate. Have you or anyone that you know of ever tried, like, pre-germinating the kernels and then planting the sprouted kernels?
Yes, you can do that. Problem is whenever you pre-germinate, and what they'll often do is start those seeds in a larger pot, and you're talking about just setting out a few plants, probably for yourself, and then you're kind of gambling at the same time. Sweet corn likes temperatures above 50 degrees Fahrenheit, and that's the soil temperature. And you can do so, start the plants, bring them up to about the fourth leaf stage, and then transplant the whole pot. If you're damaging the roots from that pot at all, it's going to stunt that plant. And that's why sweet corn is often not transplanted.
I was asking just about just that initial germination where it's just starting to sprout.
Oh, just coming out?
Yep.
Yeah, you can do that where you place them in water, and just as the root radical begins to emerge, when it's less than, I would say, a half inch, then setting them out, you can do it that way. But once you place them in the soil, if the soil is not warm enough, they're just going to sit there. And let's say that the soil temperature is at 40 degrees, that root is exposed, it's sitting there, and the bacteria are operating because they start multiplying at 35, 40 degrees. And so often we have root rots. We see that in cornfields many times. If they plant, the plants start to grow, and then we have a cold 3-4, a good week or so, and then we have a reduction in the plant population. But yes, what you suggested, you can do. Another suggestion that you might want to look at is taking some clear plastic. Once you set the plant out, build a little cold frame 2x4 box that's maybe 8 foot by 3 feet. Put clear plastic over it, and that'll give you help heat the soil up a little bit and encourage that growth. So there's a few tricks that you can try doing there.
So it's not just the germination, but rather the growth itself that requires the soil warmth.
Yes. You have to keep that thing growing so you can get ahead of the bacteria and fungal organisms that are in the soil.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Gene. Appreciate your question. And on to Rich in Summers. Hi, Rich. Oh, I'm sorry. I think I pressed the wrong button there. Oh. Rich, now you can go ahead.
Okay. Some information maybe on starting a small hobby winery in southeast Wisconsin in some tough clay soil, and are deer going to be a problem?
Well, the deer aren't going to be as problematic to grapes as they are to other types of fruit crops. The deer love the rose family, and that's all our apples and plums and some of those. So it's going to be less of a problem. But turkeys are going to be more of a problem because they jump up and hit the clusters. If you're going to start, for growing some grapes for a home winery, one, I'd take a close look at the varieties that are suggested to make sure that you select varieties that are hardy enough for the area. I know University of Minnesota has just released a couple of new varieties. One, I believe, is Marquette, and then Marquess, and then Frontenac. And down in southeastern Wisconsin, I think they'll do fairly well in terms of survival, and they do make a fairly good wine grape. Wine grapes have to have high sugar, low acids, and those have been selected. And most of the wine, or most of the grape varieties that have been introduced from Michigan, Minnesota, I don't believe, Wisconsin's had a few with the Swenson varieties. Many of those were more for eating purposes, or jellies and jams, and so they had lower sugars and higher acids. And when it comes to making wine, it's learning how to work with that situation. So I would say go ahead, select varieties that'll, one, survive winter, and two, mature within the growing period. We have some varieties out there that come from California that we might get to survive, but they're from the time they flower to the fruit is ripened, we're looking at 180 to 200 days. And there's even one variety I found that takes 230 days. Which, of course, needs a warm. It's a California grape, Mediterranean. Most of the California grapes actually came from Europe, the Mediterranean region. So take a look at what's available. Go on the Internet, do a search on cold hardy grapes, and I believe there's a couple of websites that will come up from Minnesota. There's a very large grape-growing organization over there.
Thanks.
Okay, and have you investigated the Foch grape at all?
No, just what Jung has right now.
Yeah, Foch is a French-American hybrid. It was the hardiest of what we had for wine varieties. It'll do fairly well here in southern Wisconsin. Once I get north of maybe Highway 10, I start seeing winter injury. Some of the growers up there that try growing foliage will lay them out down on the ground, and you hope for snow because they'll mulch. And this year, it's not working. But foliage should be one that you could look at. Another one is Merlot, which is a from the same breeding program that produced foliage.
And, Rich, thank you very much. Good luck to you in your efforts to come up with a good grape for wine. Mark is in Milwaukee. Hi, Mark. What's on your mind today?
Some of our dogs have a type of worm that called hookworm, where the vet told me we have to either remove the soil or bleach it. And one of our options we're looking at is just bleaching the soil. And I'm wondering what I could do to recover the soil after a bleaching process.
We're kind of crossing over to an animal situation. Are you talking about?
I'm just worried about what I do with the soil after I bleach it out.
Yeah, but where are you doing garden soil or what? Lawn?
Garden and lawn, yeah, both. There's flower gardens and lawns.
Yeah. Have you used the as a compost material the animal manure?
No. I never have, but somehow these dogs got exposed to it, and so now it's in the soil.
Okay. This is a question I probably shouldn't be even dabbling in. One of the things it does lead to, people often ask, well, if I have dog and cat manures, yes, there are some types of little parasites that can be very problematic. And we often encourage people not to utilize any of those compost manures because you can buy some composters now around any of your garden type crops.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not quite sure if the vet is saying that the dog is picking it up from the soil when it's out on the lawn or whatever it has to be. But I would check around with a lawn service that one will do that for you, because the amount of chlorine or whatever bleach material you're placing on there has to be to the point where it's not going to kill any of your plant materials. And so I'm guessing the concentration is a very tricky situation. So I would check with one of your lawn services and see what they can possibly suggest.
Okay, thanks.
All right, thank you very much. And if you'd like to join the conversation, we have a line open for you. In Madison, the number is 263-1890. Or it's toll-free at 800-642-1234. As we talk today on Garden Talk with Bob Tomesch, he's a senior lecturer in horticulture at the UW-Madison. And let's go to Sarah next for her call. Sarah's in Pella, Iowa?
Pell Lake.
Pell Lake, all right. Go ahead.
Thank you. I have this beautiful strawberry plant. It's beautiful, it's growing, it's doing great, but it's not producing anything. And I'm wondering, is there anything I should be doing now to kind of protect it or do anything to help it to produce any strawberries? Because it's growing like crazy. I have 10 runners hanging off. It's got to be replanted again, and it's just beautiful. It just isn't doing anything but being pretty.
Yeah. Is this a ornamental-type strawberry?
I don't know.
Yeah. There are some strawberry varieties out there that are more grown for their foliage, and if they do have fruit, they're very, very small. And whatever you do or how kind you are to that plant, you're probably never going to see very much for edible strawberries. But there were some that were developed for like hanging baskets, and they produce runners and they grow very nice. But for the ability to produce fruit, they were not developed for that reason. They were developed for their foliage. And I'm guessing from what you're describing, you might have one of those types of plants.
Okay. Well, what should I look for? Because it's real pretty and it turns red in the fall and stuff. But
yep.
I really want a strawberry that I can eat. So this is a dumb question, I'm sorry, but what actually am I looking for when I go pick up strawberry plants then?
Okay. You telling me it turns red, I'm sure that's what it is an ornamental, because there were some varieties that were selected for that characteristic. I would try to, if you're from Iowa, there are some very good...
No, she's actually from Pell Lake, Wisconsin.
Pell Lake, Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
I would take a look at some of the garden catalogs. There's some of the old faithfuls like Sparkle and some of those varieties. And, of course, we plant those in a garden situation, so they are subjected to winter, and that stimulates regrowth in the spring. But Sparkle's a good one, Raritan. There's a whole list of strawberry varieties that you might want to take a look at, old, and there's even some newer ones that are available. But the biggest problem whenever you're growing strawberries is good weed control and watering those plants. The weed control so that they're not shaded. If they're shaded, they produce fewer flowers and have fewer fruit on the following year. We plant those plants this year. We might see a few flowers. Usually we suggest taking those flowers off as they emerge. But when the runners begin to evolve, getting those set to root, and the earlier those runners are set, the sooner they produce flowers and the more productive they are the following year. So there's also a very good bulletin on growing strawberries in Wisconsin. You might want to take a look at that, and it'll list some other varieties that are in there besides those that I mentioned.
Okay, well, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
All right, Sarah, thank you for your call. This is Garden Talk. Our guest is Bob Tomash. He's a senior lecturer at the UW-Madison in horticulture. I'm Jim Packard, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Jim Packard, in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you along with us for Garden Talk as we continue with Bob Tomash. Bob, before we go back to the phones, let's suppose that some gardener received a gift of a new pruner for the holidays, and they're so anxious to get out and use it because the weather is so good. Is that a good idea?
Usually we suggest pruning take place in the spring, usually February and March, before we have any plant growth, because if we wait too long, we have insects that might carry diseases to those new wounds. So usually we suggest waiting on the pruning of woody plant materials to February and March, although I know the commercial apple growers are out there now, not only because it's nice weather, but it's January, and they probably have 3 months of pruning to do, so they need to get it done. But for the most part, for any homeowner that has only one or two plants that may be in need of pruning, we'd suggest waiting until late February or March. And there's some very good bulletins also on pruning that you might want to take a look at, so that we often say prune for a reason. Why are you pruning? Is that branch in the way? Or is it the tree just getting too thick or dense and we need to open it up to allow sunlight through? Or is that shrub getting too dense? There are some that need some rejuvenation, like lilac and forsythia. They get so old that the flower productivity begins to decline because the vegetative structure is so thick. And so we recommend removing about one-third of the stems. So it depends why you're pruning. If you have growing gooseberries or blueberries, again, there's some suggestions on pruning where you want to thin out some of the older wood, taking maybe one-third of the stems out, and it'll stimulate some new regrowth, and that regrowth will be more productive in the years to follow. So if you have the pruning equipment, look at prune for a reason, and then start looking at it in February and March.
On to Stuart in DeForest. Stuart, what can we do for you today?
Good morning. I get some trees from National Arbor Day Foundation every year. And the last 3 years in a row, I've tried to grow some red eastern cedars, but I've had no luck. I've tried growing them in my garden, tried planting them in pots sunk in the garden. I've tried them in plants or pots not sunk in the ground. And this year, I actually put some wilt proof on them, and one of them made it till fall of the three that I planted. But I wonder if you had any ideas on growing those cedars.
Do you know what the genus and species of that cedar is?
No, not off the top of my head.
Yeah.
Eastern red cedar is what they call them.
Eastern red cedar. Eastern red cedar should make it up here because they grow naturally. One of the things when they ship evergreens, for example, if the roots dry out too much, they just don't have the viability to really get started. So if you're not seeing any growth after you plant them, that's probably what's happening. Also, whenever you receive some plant material like that in the mail, I would suggest soaking those roots for about 4 hours or so prior to planting. Soaking them in regular water and then setting the plant material out. Don't over-soak them. If you soak them for a day or two, they run out of oxygen, and so that's more detrimental than not soaking at all. So when you receive those red cedar, try doing that. The reason I ask you what species you had, because there are some plants that are called red cedars, and they come out of some of the southern areas that they're just not hardy enough for up here. So that's one of the other things I'd look at. I know when you order stuff from the National Arborist Association or Arbor Day Association, they have some plant materials in there because they service the whole country, and they have plant materials that are just not hardy enough for here, Wisconsin.
Yeah,
See, when they send them, they always have like some type of a gel to keep the roots moist, and then I always soak them for a while. But I don't know if it's just that maybe I'm not watering them enough throughout the summer, or watering them too much. They usually die. If they die, they usually die after about 2 weeks. But yep. This year, like I said, I use Wilproof, and they last a lot longer.
It sounds like the problem is when you plant the plants, I would suggest watering those plants about every 2 days or so for the first 3 weeks. And after that, cutting back and watering them about every 5 and then about once a week. And I don't know if you're in a sandier area or whatever, that'll play some role as to their survival. But if they're not coming out of it in the spring, there's something going on. Either they're not viable by the time, they might be green when you receive them, but that doesn't mean that they're alive.
Right. Okay.
All right, Stuart, thank you very much. You appreciate your call. The number in Madison is a local one at 263-1890, otherwise toll-free at 800-642-1234. And on to Tom in Sheboygan. Hi, Tom. What can we do for you?
Good morning, Jim and Bob. Mm-hmm. I'm calling about the gentleman that asked a question about germinating corn seeds. I know a fellow in Plymouth. He's got a CSA, a consumer-supported agricultural farm, named Springdale Farm. He does do that on a large basis, and I'm one of the members there. I've worked this.
Yeah, it's possible, but what I was suggesting is... Even when he does it, he probably watches the soil temperature very closely. And what his whole goal is to get that earliest sweet corn crop out there, as with anyone else. And so it's very important to kind of go along with it. So once you set those pre-germinated seeds out, they can't sit in the ground for several weeks. They'll have to start growing within a couple of weeks. Otherwise, you're going to have a reduction in population. And I know a number of the fresh market growers that I work with that do some of that type of thing. What they do is they plant about every 7 days, and what they're doing is gambling. Well, maybe I'll lose that 7 days worth of crop, but the next 7 days maybe I will have caught the soil temperatures and everything else appropriately. But again, the goal is to catch that early productivity. And in the case of CSAs, it allows for the provision of vegetables at an earlier stage, and of course you sell more conscriptions that way.
What he does is he's got plastic frames that I don't know whether he invented these himself or not, but they'll hold 100 seeds. They'll put them into about 1 to 1.5 squares of potting soil, and then once they start to produce a small plant, a seedling, they can be popped out and put into beds in a greenhouse. And then I'm not sure when they're transferred into the field, but like you said, he does get a good jump on the season. I worked there in May, and they're still doing that in May, so...
Right, and I know there's a grower up by Eau Claire area that shoots for some of the early plantings in early to mid-April, depending on the weather, of course, and they do some of that same thing. Again, like I suggested earlier, is using a large enough pot somewhere along the way. You can start out with the small plugs and move it to a larger pot and then move it out to the outside. The other issue you're dealing with, if you have one night of frost, once that plant is beyond the fourth leaf stage, the growing point is no longer below the soil line, and so... in a situation like that, the frost would kill that growing point, and so that plant would then die. But what he's doing is he's moving along trying to get the early season. For a homeowner trying to do that with 20 seeds or whatever, that's fine. You can get a jump on it. I've tried it a couple times using the greenhouse, making a small little movable hotbed, if you might call it, and clear plastic over the soil to warm the soil up a little bit. And, yes, you can get a little bit of growth there. Try to beat the neighborhood, and that type of thing. I'd even cheat and put in a few tomato plants that way. And of course, tomatoes, they're pretty resilient. You can grow them inside mm-hmm. and then move the pot out. But growing spinach and radishes, some of those crops right along with it, you can have a fairly early productivity.
Tom, thank you very much for that observation. We had an email from Stephen in Madison, 15 years experience in restoration ecology. He's had great success with winter herbicide applications on cool season plants. In fact, some of my most efficient elimination has occurred in February at temperatures well below 45 degrees. My observations indicate as long as there's available free water and the plant is active or green, herbicide will work. In fact, I don't recommend herbicide applications to occur in temperatures above 75 degrees. So give me several days of 40-degree weather in January, adequate soil moisture, and I'll show you dead plants.
He's right, and he's above 75. That's another point, is because the herbicides will evaporate quite rapidly. And he's had experience with the growing. The other thing that oftentimes when they apply herbicides is not only the green tissue, but they're also applying a herbicide I've noticed in some of the for garlic mustard control is it prevents root development. And what that does is it stymies the growth of the new seedlings that might occur in the spring. So his experience, and we're looking at those types of opportunities. And as I pointed out, garlic mustard has a growing point where it's around 34, 35 degrees, which is relatively cool. And so if they're carrying on photosynthesis, and we've had warm temperatures, mm-hmm. they might have some success.
Well, we had some late leaf drop, and so I went out this week and did the raking out in the front yard, and I could see that the Creeping Charlie was just as bright and emerald green as possible.
That's another plant that grows very early.
So this is an opportunity, if we still have a couple of good days, where I could sneak out there and apply an application and see if I could knock that out before spring.
You can try. We're not always recommending that this time of the year because there's also failure that comes along with the success.
That's true. And if it gets cold and everything, well, then it just runs off and, you know, there's my problem. Bob Tomesch is our guest. He's a senior lecturer in horticulture at the UW-Madison and with UW Extension on this edition of Garden Talk. We'll pause, catch up on the latest news, and come back and take your calls and your questions here on Garden Talk. The number in Madison is 263-1890. Otherwise, it's toll free at 800-642-1234. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Jim Packard, sitting in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you along with us this afternoon as we continue with Garden Talk. Bob Tomesch is our guest. He's a senior lecturer at the UW-Madison and in Extension Horticulture. Bob, a pleasure to have you with us today.
Yes, Jim.
Thanks for joining in. Our lines are full, but when the line opens, the number in Madison will be 263-1890, otherwise toll-free at 800-642-1234. And let's go to the phones to Kate in Arena. Kate, hi. Thanks for waiting.
Hi. I have a two-part blueberry question. We have some property that seems to have some wild blueberries on it, and I didn't know that was really possible in southwest Wisconsin. They look, you know, they're small, and they look kind of stunted, but they look like blueberries, and we've tasted them, and they're okay. So I'm wondering what those varieties might be. And then my second part of my question is if we were to experiment with cultivated varieties, would it make sense for us to actually kind of plant those cultivated varieties in the wild woods setting in around that same environment where the already established wild ones are?
Okay. Yes, there are wild blueberries along all of western Wisconsin and northern Wisconsin. You find them in localized areas. One of the things you could do is just culture those wild ones that you have. If it's close to the house or whatever, you could water that area when it's dry. Place some leaf mulch or something like that or bark chips down to kind of help them along a little bit to retain their moisture in the soil. So that's one thing. The reason they're growing there is because there's an environmental condition and maybe the soil pH is appropriate that they'll, you know, that's already preconditioned, and planting your cultivated varieties in that area. The wild ones are a little different species than the cultivated ones. The cultivated ones come from the half-high and high-bush type. Minnesota has some very good releases out there, that North Blue, North Country, North Sky. I think of those, North and Northland. North Blue, I've experimented with that one, and I think that's a half-high variety that gets about 3 or 4 feet tall, very productive, and you might want to consider that in that area.
Okay.
Water is going to be the main thing that you're going to have to, if you want regular production and very good production, is to provide either the wild plants or the cultivated.
Okay, and the earlier caller about blueberries, what was the suggestion for water? Twice a week?
If you're in a sandy or light soil, I'd say about every 5 days. And make sure that you apply an ample amount. Or some people, there's some real interesting home irrigation systems that are coming out with drip and other things like that. And I've been trying to encourage people to take a look at some of those that are, and you'll see them beginning to show up in the garden catalogs. And you can purchase some of that irrigation stuff for about between $50 and $100. But what it allows you to do is use it in your home garden. You can use some of it in the around your things like blueberries and that. And we're looking at probably 3/4 of an inch of water application. If you're going to surface water, apply it about every 5 days.
Okay. And there wouldn't be any problem as far as having variety crossing if we did purchased.
No, that's not going to be a problem. In fact, it's going to even help out in the pollination.
Okay, because that certainly seems to be where blueberries want to grow. So I think we'll try that. Okay.
Well, good luck, Kate. Thank you very much for your call. And let's go to Jim in Blue River. And Jim, what's on your mind today?
Well,
more blueberries.
More blueberries. I've had a blueberry row out here in Grand County for about 25 years. And I just thought a couple of things I wanted to bring up. By acidifying the soil with sulfur, and then I had to put a little terrace in because I didn't want to lose that soil down the slope, putting in a drip irrigation system in my blueberries, by the time I got them all netted and with frames, I figured my first quart of blueberries cost me well over $100. So I think these people ought to know what they're getting into. I did two things that you didn't mention. I sunk a half-inch PVC pipe through the row, and I drilled holes in it with just a regular drill bit. And I put a connection on the end, and I just attach a garden hose to that. And that gets over that shallow root system that they have.
Mm-hmm.
It works really slick. The other thing I caution the people to do is be real careful about how you net these things. I made frames and put one-inch chicken wire around mine, but birds like them better than we do. And you want blueberries to be on the bush for a week or so after they turn blue to get the adequate sugars in them. Otherwise, they're not a real sweet berry. And so you really want to be sure you get them well netted. Otherwise, you're going to lose your entire crop. Birds have crawled right under a regular light netting that you get. I use one-inch chicken wire.
Yep, very good suggestions. 25 years of experience, and that has brought out some interesting things that people might want to consider. And birds are like feeding on them. Chipmunks enjoy them just as well. And as he pointed out, about 2 days before you're going to harvest, some bird comes in there and
swipes everything.
Swipes everything, yes.
Jim, thank you very much.
You bet.
All right, we appreciate hearing from you. If you have a comment or a question to include, give us a call in Madison at 263-1890, or it's toll-free at 800-642-1234. Helen is in Freedom, and she's next. Helen, what's on your mind?
Yes. Do you know of a Christmas cactus that has blossoms that look like dolphins?
I don't know that variety per se. You might want to check with your local garden center or a supplier of houseplants, and they could probably give you that one exactly.
We have looked everywhere, and we can't find it. So I was just wondering if you knew, but we'll still keep looking.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate hearing from you. And Denise is in Menasha. Denise, what can we do for you?
Good morning. I'm calling because my dad lives in the same house he's lived in for about the last 35 years, and his backyard, we never cut the grass before the end of May, like the third week in May, and his backyard is literally covered with wildflowers. The only thing is there's a lot of creeping Charlie in there, too, and because you guys were talking about the herbicides a little earlier, that made me wonder if there's any way to get rid of the creeping Charlie without the risk of killing off the wildflowers.
Okay, a lot of the wildflowers that you have there have a relatively short window of growth, and that's in the spring.
Yes.
In fact, most wildflowers have developed under a tree canopy. Once the tree canopy gets large, the top portion just dies off, and that's usually about 6 or 8 weeks into the growth. You might want to look at a control for creeping Charlie. And I would suggest looking in, there's in the bulletin that John Stiers put together on turf management, there are some fall applications for controlling creeping Charlie. In fact, creeping Charlie control is best done in the fall. Not that you kill the plant outright, but you weaken it enough that it just can't survive winter. And so you might want to look at trying some of that. And I would only take a small corner or maybe one-third of it. So in the effect, they would have some impact on your wildflowers. You'd soon be able to tell whether there is some impact there, so you're not devastating the whole backyard.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for your call, Denise. And we move on to arborvitae and to Jim. Jim, what can we do for you today?
Well, I had a little thing here I wanted to tell you about, and you might have heard of this. But I took a tree that was cut off, and it was an arborvitae that it was, and this was up in Duluth and Clay Country. And I had heard that you could dig a trench and put that in the ground, and it would grow into a tree. And I did that. I took another tree that I actually dug up, and I planted it in the ground just for comparison. Now, the one that I laid in the ground was about 10 feet long, and I cut everything off that came up through the soil until I got to the one part that I wanted. And today, you couldn't tell one of them from the other. Have you ever heard of that being done?
It's way of propagating. Usually your evergreens are more difficult to propagate than your hardwood type of plant or deciduous trees. It can be done. You must have did it right, because along with doing that, also you need a certain amount of water, moisture at the right time to keep those roots going. So apparently you did the steps right, and most people won't plant a 10-foot section horizontally, but in your case it did work, and it's a way of propagating plant material. If you really want, some plants that are more successful would be doing something like willow, which you probably almost have 100% success.
Oh yeah, you can just cut a willow and just stick it in the ground, it'll grow.
And you have also snow mulch cover right now, right?
Pardon me?
I see you got plenty of snow up there right now, right?
Oh, up there? I don't think so.
Oh.
We don't live there no more, see? And but we do go back up there, and I think they got less snow there than what we do here in arborvitae.
I meant in arborvitae.
Oh, in arborvitae, right now there's probably only an inch and a half or 2 inches is melting.
Oh, okay.
It's so warm out here now that it's dangerously warm.
Dangerously warm.
Well, Jim. Everything gets iced up because of this warm temperature.
Right, right. That's that freeze-thaw cycle
that we
began the show with.
And you can't even go out and walk now. Everything is glare ice on the side roads.
Yep.
Jim, thanks for your observations and your questions, your comments. And let's go to Diane in Neshota next. Hello, Diane.
Hello. I believe I have diagnosed anthracnose on my maple trees. I have a Schwedler red maple and a Norway maple full size in our front lawn, and we also are surrounded on two sides by heavy woods. And the mature maples and the saplings all have, or did have this summer, these black spots and some very colorful orange spots. The leaves crinkled up and fell way before the normal leaf drop. And so we cleaned up as many as we could, which is very difficult, and we just put them on a gigantic pile at the side of our lot, which is very large. And I don't believe I'm supposed to burn them.
No, you're wondering what to do with the leaves?
Well, what to do with the leaves, and is there anything I can do next spring other than pick up every last leaf that I spy and hope for the best?
Yeah. Well, first of all, the two varieties that you named are very susceptible to many diseases. The black spots could have been anthracnose. It could have been tar spot. If you really want to know, you can send a sample to Brian Huddleston down in the pathology lab, and he does that type of diagnosis. Or you can send it in through your county extension office. There's a fee for that diagnosis, and he'll also send you some suggestions. As to the leaves that you raked up, a couple of choices that you can do is some of those will release spores in the spring. If you want to go through a composting process, you might want to, place a piece of plastic or tarp over them and kind of water them a little bit in the spring, and that'll get that decomposition going, and usually in about 3-4 weeks, they'll break down enough that'll kind of take care of some of that sporulation that's that you've trapped in there.
If I leave the pile alone for a year or so, would it be safe to use those composted leaves?
You're using those for compost. Usually my suggestion is materials that you compost out of the garden, use that compost around your trees and shrubs. The materials of like leaf tissue and that from your trees and shrubs, when that's composted, place that in the garden, because usually the diseases are not quite as transferable from one type of plants to the other.
I only have perennial plants. I don't have
the perennials,
vegetable garden.
Using that on the perennials will work well.
Oh, okay. But then what about the trees next spring? If it looks like they're developing the same problem, are they in danger of dying?
No, it just is a cosmetic type of thing on the leaves. Sometimes they'll get stressed enough, you might attribute it to the leaves, but there could be some other diseases going on, like some root rots, or sometimes we have some cankers that get started on the stems. Those two varieties of maples are also not real winter hardy, and so when we have a real warm spell now and then we get a cold snap, sometimes that will kill some of the cambial tissue, and then that opens it up for canker. So you might have more than just the leaf tissue stress going on. It's a cosmetic thing. Large trees, we more or less live with it. Some years it's worse than others. It depends on the weather conditions that we have.
Well, I am very relieved. I thought we were going to lose those two big trees.
Yeah. Like I said, you might have more than just the leaf problem going on. And if they defoliate early next year, you might want to get an arborist in to take a look at it, because it could be some root damage that might have occurred or something like that.
Okay. Now, if I could just get some kind of a disease to kill the thousands of, what are those horrible trees, buckthorn trees in the woods.
Yes, we all wished we could.
Diane, thank you so much for your call. And Leslie in Eau Claire, what's on your mind today?
Well, I'm interested in winterberry bushes. We have a local fast food restaurant that has some stunning ones in their parking lot, and they are just solid red berries, really, really striking. And I was talking to a friend who said he also likes them and bought 4 bushes 3 years ago, but hardly gets a berry on his. So I want to get winterberry bushes, but I want to know what they need to really produce a lot of berries.
Well, when you say they have red berries on, are you sure they're winter berries and they're not a type of American cranberry bush or something like that?
Well, I asked what they were, and I was told they were winter berries.
Okay.
It's a very hard berry.
Yep.
But they're just solid, not like the ones you see in the ditches in the wild where there's just
right.
sort of scattered berries on it.
Well, the reason you see scattered berries is that plant comes in both male and female. And when you have the male plant, no berries. And so, and oftentimes when you buy them from the nursery, they may specify that a plant is female. What they've done is taken cuttings from another female plant and propagated those plants in that respect. If they just use seedlings, you don't know what you're going to have, a male or a female. So when you're purchasing those from a nursery, and I'm sure you can look at some of the local nursery catalogs and find wintergreen in. The other challenging issue with growing that plant is it likes a moisture-type soil and also proper pH. And so sometimes those are a little bit of a challenge to grow as well.
Strong sunshine, or do they like partial shade? Or
they tend to prefer full sunlight, to at least 6 to 8 hours of sunlight during the summer.
Okay, I live in a shale hill, so that doesn't sound ideal.
Well,
but I could water them a lot. Any other recommendations other than plant them in the sunny location?
Yeah, I would take one of the things is there's a the guide to selecting landscape plants for Wisconsin. It's the extension bulletin, and they do have wintergreen in there, and it'll also give you some site recommendations and pH. Now, you tell me you're on a shale, which tells me you might have high soil pH, and that type of plant doesn't always like a high soil pH situation.
So it likes a low pH?
A lower pH. We're talking probably 6 or below.
Okay, and what would I put in my soil to achieve
that? Well, you're going to have to probably modify it just like you had for blueberries.
Okay. Well, that's helpful. Thank you very much.
I might just be able to give you a little hint here at environment as I'm looking at it. Winterberry. why don't you take another question, and then we'll come back to that one, okay?
Let me ask you this, Bob. The address on the Internet for these publications that you've mentioned from University Extension, is that address cecommerce@ces.uwex.edu?
That is it.
Okay.
And you can take or stop at your local extension office, and they would have that bulletin.
Right.
I pulled that information up here, and yes, they like a wet, acid-type soil will tolerate poor drainage. And usually in the wild, you find them growing next to a marsh or a wetter environment. They do come in male and female plants, and so you want to purchase the female plant. As to in their zone 4A, yeah, they'll grow across most of Wisconsin. Some of the wild type ones will do much better in the northern half of the state than some of the cultivated varieties. They'll grow both in sun and semi-shade, so but it's a wetness and a soil pH issue that enhances the survival of that plant.
Good luck to you, and on to Bill in Dubuque. And Bill, what can we do for you?
Hello, can you hear me all right?
Yes, we can.
Okay, I've got a system of growing vegetables, some vegetables and some fruits, where I can have real good control over the watering. And some of these plants, like exotic melons from France and Spain, you can get too much water in. It's hard to keep a good balance. Is there some place where I can find out which balance, how much water? I have an instrument that will measure 0%, 10%, 90%. And I don't know which level to keep it at. Is there anywhere I can find out what are the best levels for different plants?
You're asking questions where you probably have to go to almost a textbook-type situation. There's a person by the name of Knott, K-N-O-T-T, vegetable production, and I believe it might have some of that hydrology information in there. The other thing you might want to look at doing is when you set up your planting situation for those types of vegetables. And yes, there are some that can't tolerate wet soil conditions, but build a mound up of soil so that's about 6 inches higher than the rest. And what that will do is, as that vegetable's growing in that area, that mound will dry out more rapidly, and those roots will tend to kind of develop in an area based on the dryness or the wetness farther down so that they will survive much better. So you might want to try looking at a mounding situation. And if it's in a greenhouse situation, some people will take a 2x4 or a 2x6, space it maybe about 12 to 18 inches, and then fill their soil into that mound, and that'll allow it to dry out.
Yeah, okay. How do I get a hold of this not vegetable products?
Vegetable book, growing vegetables. Go down to your local library and do a search for this person, Knott, and there's probably other Knott authors that wrote other types of books, but there's one that focuses on vegetable production, and that's kind of used as a textbook in vegetable production classes.
It's a book. Yes. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
All right, Bill. Thank you very much. And let's see if we can get Nancy's question in Madison answered. Hi, Nancy.
Yes, hi. I'm calling because I followed the directions of what you're supposed to do after you have two hard freezes and covered up a perennial garden with branches and mulch. And now I'm just wondering, because everything is thawed, of course, if I am just promoting insect growth or whatever by leaving all this on top of the garden, and is it heating up, and should I rake it off, or should I just leave it alone?
Good question. I'd just leave it alone because even though the other soil around us is freezing and thawing, that temperature is probably moderating at a fairly stable level. And so it's not fluctuating like it would be in other parts of your yard. So just leave it alone, and next spring when we're doing your cleanup and everything else, and then take it off.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Could I ask another question just generally?
It's got to be really quick because we only have a few seconds left to go.
Right. It's about the climate changing, whether there's going to be new literature coming out and telling people how to adapt to this.
Well, we don't know if it's really happening yet, but we'll keep on top of it.
It's an issue that you'll hear covered here extensively, and if things do come out, you'll hear about it. Nancy, thank you very much. Bob, thank you very much for being with us today. We'll look forward to your next visit.
Thank you, Jim.
Bob Tolmesh is a senior lecturer at the UW-Madison and Extension Horticulture. He has a lot to do with the Master Gardener program across the state. And again, if you'd like to check on the bulletins that we've mentioned, cecommerce@ces.uwex.edu is the address. Next week on Garden Talk, Dick Zondag will be along, president of the Jung Seed Company. Our thanks to Keisha Mabra for on-air phone production today. I'm Jim Packard. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.